Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome back to the Reformed Dissenters. That's the show where Reformed Christians dissent against popular ideas of culture by asserting a biblical worldview. Today we are talking about Adam Terrell's book. Mr. Adam Terrell wrote a book called Public Stoning, God's Design for a Nation Without Prisons. And I, Bruce Johnson, with my brother Jacob Johnson.
Hello everybody.
We are going to be breaking down this book, and today we're talking about chapters 7 and 8. So if you've missed previous episodes, you've missed previous chapters, you may be a smidge lost, probably not hugely lost. But if you were coming here expecting to get an answer to the question of, do these guys believe in public stoning and why? Well, you're going to want to catch the rest of the previous episodes for a fully comprehensive answer to that question. Short answer is yes.
The long answer is yes.
There it is. It's just a wonderful book. Very well written. We've only found one or two itty bitty critiques. Which we've tackled in previous episodes. But, you know, as we've stated multiple times, the stated goal of this book is to start getting people to ask questions, right? So the goal is not to answer every possible question, although, as I'll be discussing in a minute, Chapter 7 answers quite a few of all the possible questions that could be raised. but the goal is really to start a conversation. And it's to start people thinking, again, like we used to. The stupid thing is we've lost so much over the last century and a half because of stupid dispensational theology creeping into the church like a cancer, rotting our foundations and splitting us in innumerable ways and just destroying so much of our wonderful heritage we had prior to the rot of dispensational theology. So we're trying to get it back. We're trying to recuperate. We're trying to regrow the dying limbs and heal them and fix them. And it all starts with understanding the importance of both the Old and the New Testaments. The Old and New Covenants are vitally and dramatically important to everyday life. And if we don't get that, and we don't place a high level of importance equally on the Old Testament as we do the New, then things are a little askew. Now, yes, Hebrews says we are in a new covenant built on better promises. But to think that that means we no longer have to consider things like public stoning or consider those principles that God laid out literally for us to construct civilizations, a civilization, to think that we could just throw all of that away is insanity. And that's directly what this book confronts. So, before we get into everything that we have in store for you today, and there will be some controversial matters we'll discuss, we have to do what we always do, and that's talk about our verse of the week. And Fridays means that Jacob does that, so take it away.
Yeah, and our verse this week is found in 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3 through 5. And these verses say, "For though we walk in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and take every thought captive to obey Christ." And those were verses 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3 through 5. I also wanted to bring up another verse, but I think I want to talk a little bit about this and break this down into some key points here, right? Our weapons have this divine power, right? We have the knowledge of God. That is a weapon. We have the Bible. That's the knowledge of God given to us that we can read through and use as our weapon. Bruce was kind of explaining on Wednesday that we have this nuclear bomb that is the Bible that can destroy every opinion, can destroy any argument. And why should we fear? Why should we fear our enemy that tries to come and attack us? Why should we fear when we have this bomb? Why should we fear when we have this weapon called the Bible? So in that, it's not what we think. We're not going out there destroying and doing all this. We're doing this in a way where we don't destroy civilizations. We destroy arguments. We destroy opinions that are raised against God. I wanted to add to this and talk about, what is it? Psalm 127, verse 3. Verse 3 starts out saying, Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. Obviously, this man is a father having children and having many children, one that will fill his quiver with them and sharpening them with the knowledge of God. This is very important because, and I very interesting, this simile here, where it's talking about these weapons being something not physical, but in a sense spiritual, but not in the way that we think. This is something that you're raising children. This father's weapons are his children. And going out and destroying lofty opinions, destroying his enemies, and this is our weapon. This is one of the weapons. This family is warfare, much like worship is warfare. So that's also very interesting to bring that psalm. Hold on, let me say it again. Psalms 123, verses 3 through 5, if anybody was wanting to look that up. 127, right? I'm sorry. Yep. So, yeah. Hopefully that was added good points. Absolutely. To that.
It added good. Thanks, Jake. So today we are talking about chapters 7 and 8 in Adam Terrell's book, Public Stoning, God's Design for a Nation Without Prisons. And, you know, we spent all of last week's episode in this book, discussing chapter 6, because there was just so much there to get through. Chapter 6 was kind of the... If you have questions, you have objections, you come to this book simply reading the title and you've never even entertained this idea before and you're like, what? How could that be right? Like, I usually just like to kind of gloss over those passages and pretend they don't exist. Kind of embarrassed by them, really. If heathens were to read those, that would kind of ruin their chances of being saved, wouldn't it? Like, they're not going to come to Christ if he advocates for public stoning, are they? And yet, our perfect, all-loving, and just God advocates for public stoning. Public stoning is his form of justice for specific crimes. How do we reconcile those two things? And he spent a large portion of chapter 6 discussing many of the objections people like that would raise. Chapter 7 actually is kind of a continuation of that same thought process, trying to address many of the objections people would raise to the scriptural challenges of those sorts of things. So last week was more of the, but what about this? Have you thought about this? This chapter, though, he's thinking through some of the scriptural things that people would bring up. And he starts by talking about, what about the Sermon on the Mount? Didn't Jesus say to turn the other cheek? Shouldn't we just forgive those worthy of death? And he provides a much more lengthy response to this question in this chapter. So as we always say, we're not an audiobook for this book. So if you really get your own copy of this and read this part, especially chapter 7, because he spends a lot of time going through the logic about what it actually means to turn the other cheek. Page 78, he says, quote, Jesus is not contradicting the law here. He is offering the satisfaction for its requirement. Godly forgiveness is not always based on payment. Is always based on payment, on atonement. I'll say that again. Godly forgiveness is always based on payment, on atonement. If it were not, God could pardon without Christ's death. God can't cheat himself. He is perfectly just. Payments must be made. When someone strikes a person, the law says that stripe for stripe is the appropriate payment. Jesus is teaching that payment can be made at the expense of the victim. And he spends a lot more time fleshing this out in this part of the chapter, so I highly encourage checking out. Later on down the page, he says, so when Jesus says to turn the other cheek or go the extra mile, it is commanding us to offer payment for wrongs committed against us to satisfy justice. So there's lots more here. He gives an example of someone who, he says, like, a man named Victor steals someone named Penny's coat. Penny gives him another coat. So now he has two coats. A week passes, so when Victor is caught and brought to justice, the penalty is for Victor to return two coats to Penny. Victor already has the one he stole from Penny, so he returns that. Where does he get the other coat that he must add to it to satisfy justice? He got the second one from Penny, which she gave him at the time of the robbery. In the end, Penny will have both coats back that were originally hers, and Victor will not owe her any coats. He's restored to his original status before his theft. So it's very interesting. I think this is a fascinating biblical thought experiment to step through. Obviously, Christ is expounding on, and this was something that Adam Terrell brought up previously, when Christ gives all these things, he is by no means diminishing the law. If anything, he's expanding it. He's extending it. He's saying, you thought it was this. It's even more than that. You know, like, all right, buddy, you thought you were keeping it doing this. Well, I'm here to tell you there's more. But wait, there's more. So there's, you know, when you've heard it was said, you know, don't commit adultery. I say to you, if anyone thinks about a woman in his heart with lust, he's committed adultery with her in his mind, right? That is an extension. That's like, yes, this and then some, right? So there are, you know, Christ is always adding to and further extrapolating additional things out of the law. And we're not seeing him here saying that law of restitution doesn't matter anymore. Oh yeah, someone, well, actually here, I'll give another quote, page 79. He says, quote, also, we must note that Jesus doesn't use examples of capital offenses. He doesn't say, if anyone should murder your wife, let him murder your daughter. He leaves it to cases of property theft, non-lethal violence, and forced labor. We are prohibited from putting a substitute to death for the life of a murderer. Numbers 35, 30 through 33. This is God's right alone to substitute himself for matters of life and death, since he is the only one who has his own life to give. God owns himself, men do not. Mm. All right, so I'm going to move on to the next objection someone might raise. What about the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus said, looking at a woman with lust is adultery in the heart? Should people be stoned for that, or murder in the heart? Matthew 5, 21 through 28. Says on page 82, quote, earthly justice does not save anyone. It is simply showing the fruit of our righteousness by faith as works. And it's an example for the unbelievers to see God's justice displayed, since they only have earthly eyes to see. All sin leads to death, but God has not placed a responsibility on us to put people to death or even punish at all for most sins, and certainly not sins of the heart that do not bear fruit as actions. People cannot witness the intentions of a man's heart except by that man's actions. End quote. And that's so true. This is why literally every conversation about God's law and civil government has to involve, to some degree, excuse me, a conversation about the difference between sin and crime. There's a difference between a sin and a crime. And all crimes are sin, but not all sin is a crime. And in this case, what was brought up here is an internal sin that is still something that deserves death, but that death is vertical. That is between God and man. Hmm. When we're talking about a crime, it has a vertical component, obviously, because all sin does, but it also has a horizontal component to it. It's visible. It bears fruit in society. People can see it. It's an action that was committed and that must be punished in the way that the Bible says it should be punished. So there's a difference between sins and crimes, and that's vitally important to any conversation about applying God's law to civil government. Finally, he also brings up an example. What about the woman caught in adultery? And this is John 7:53 through 8:11. And he brings up a point that I'm shocked that no one else has brought this up before, because I've thought this for a year and a half to 2 years now, because this passage does not actually show up in most manuscripts. This passage is an addition from, I'll just read what he has here because he explains it really well. It's important to note that this passage currently has one of the most dubious reputations in the New Testament as far as its scriptural authenticity is concerned. It does not appear in any surviving manuscripts at all until 384 AD in Latin. It has not been found in a Greek manuscript earlier than 400 to 600 AD, and not in a reliable Greek manuscript until the 700s AD. For this reason, I am not convinced that John 7:53 through 8:11 is scripture. End quote. And I tend to agree with him. It's not in the original manuscripts. Until 384 AD, this was not included. I think you could stop there. But I mean, let's keep going, which he does. And he makes a really good case. Let's just assume for a second that that's true. The story with the adulterous woman who everyone wanted to stone, and they said, "What? Christ, should we stone him?" They were trying to challenge him, of course. And he says, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone," which is what everybody says today. But public stoning, Christ said, if you don't have sin, then you can stone people. But if you do have sin, then you can't. It's like, it's not what he was saying. And he lists, how many here? Oh my goodness. Three major objections to that argument that are just tremendous. And so many of them, like the first one, he says, it takes a man and a woman to commit adultery, at least one of whom must be married. If she was caught in the act, where was the man she was found with? He should have been brought forward also. Second point he says is Jesus was not a judge in Israel. He is indeed the judge of the world and will come again to judge it, but he did not come to judge the world at his first coming. John 3:17, 12, 47. The Pharisees were pulling a stunt by asking someone who was not a judge in Israel to offer an opinion. And then his third objection, if Jesus was repealing the death penalty, then this conundrum doesn't make any sense for the Pharisees to present to Jesus, because Jesus accused the Pharisees of rejecting Moses' law, commanding the stoning of rebellious children. Mark 7:9-13. What sense would it make for the Pharisees to pose this dichotomy to him when Jesus already condemned them for not executing rebellious children because of their traditions? Jesus said they've made the word of God void by their traditions. So, there's lots more there, and there were several more objections, but I'm out of time in my segment, so look up the rest of those if you have further objections to the content of this book. Otherwise, Mr. Terrell, you've outdone yourself. Thank you so much for including this chapter. Jake, what the heck is chapter 8 talking about?
Oh, it's not bad. I mean, it's good. Like, the majority of it is good. I have one issue at the end, but we'll discuss this when we get to it. Chapter 8 is Jurisdiction in a Nation Without Borders. This is very interesting. I think his first point is actually very interesting, and I would like a little bit more to substantiate his point, but I do, for the most part, I do agree with his point. I wish there was a little bit more to back it up in case someone had issues with it. But what he says on page 96 is, the highest level of earthly jurisdiction is designed by God to end ideally at the city level. Higher jurisdictions are God's judgment of failure on the part of a city, county, state, federal, or international. Which is very interesting to think about, that the end of the government, or the end of the civil government, is at the city. If I'm reading that right, is that... Highest level of earthly jurisdiction is designed by God to end ideally at the city. Yeah. Interesting.
Interesting. Yeah.
He continues on, even Israel's kingdom was the result of moral failure on the part of God's people, 1 Samuel 8. War is to be made on a city-by-city basis. It is not necessarily the case that a neighboring city should also receive the same treatment merely because it belongs to the same nation, end quote. So this is very interesting, you know, that each city has its own militias, has its own jurisdiction over, hey, we're going to war with this other nation. Or actually, he continues on, so it's not necessarily a war with another nation. I'll just continue so what I'm saying makes sense. On page 97, Adam Terrell continues. They sent, this is talking about the 12 tribes. The Levite. There we go. Okay. So he continues on, they sent men throughout the whole tribe of Benjamin, urging them to give up the worthless murderers for judgment. So a Levite went into the tribe of Benjamin and was hiding because he had murdered someone, murdered his concubine. And so then Israel was going in and like, hey, give us back this murderer. When the tribe of Benjamin refused the rest of Israel, the rest of Israel made war against the city of Gibeah, not the whole tribe of Benjamin. And God confirmed that the war was appropriate when they inquired of him. Judges 20:12 through 23. Which I thought was very interesting. Like these wars are made city by city. I'm assuming the nation of Israel all banded together, all these cities came together and were like, okay, hey, you know, we're going after this one city because they aren't giving up this, murderer who, you know, who needs to be brought to justice. So I thought that was very interesting. And I would like to see a little bit more to substantiate that point, but I definitely think for the most part, I agree with that. He continues on page 98 to talk about something interesting, which leads us into kind of my disagreement. However, I do kind of like this beginning part. He talks about, hold on. Yeah. Okay. Let me just read through it and it will explain it better than when I explain it. He brings up these question and answer from this verse, 1 Corinthians, 5:11-13. He uses that verse to create this sort of like question and answer dialogue. He begins, question, what if a believer commits an offense against another believer? Answer, is it not those inside whom you are to judge? Is it not those inside whom you are to judge? That is from that verse. Question, what if an unbeliever commits an offense against another believer? For what have I to do with judging outsiders? Question, what if a believer commits a capital offense? Is it not those inside whom you are to judge? Question, what if an unbeliever commits a capital offense? Answer, for what have I to do with judging outsiders? Question again, what if an unbeliever commits an offense against an unbeliever? Is it not those inside whom you are to judge? Question, what if an unbeliever commits an offense against a believer? Answer, for what have I to do with judging outsiders? So you kind of get the point. Which kind of brings up a little bit of my hesitation. And yeah. You seem to have a little bit of...
well, I have thought. What if... He's just referring to the church.
Yeah, and I thought that. I wish that was made clear. It might have been made clear, and I missed it. But I'm not seeing that. Because
the church...
It's still talking about city.
That's very interesting.
If it's talking about the church, I definitely would agree. But
see... I would differ on this point about the city thing because what do we see Jethro talking to Moses? How did Moses end up structuring it where we get our democratic republic form of civil government today? We get telescoping, and it goes all the way down to a man over 10 families.
Yeah.
Right. So it goes past, that's past, to me, in my mind, that's past the city level. Unless the city is comprised just of 10 families. That's a very small city.
No, he's saying the highest end. The most, the highest it goes. It doesn't go any past the city.
Oh. I'm sorry. I thought it meant down. Oh. No. That's very interesting.
Yeah, no, he's saying that there's and again, I don't, am I reading this wrong?
Yeah.
that could be everything, but it's like, is it, he's saying that the highest level of earthly jurisdiction is designed by God to end, ideally, at the city level. Higher jurisdictions.
All right, this are will God's be something. Judgment. Let's write this down. So yes. When we have him on the show, this will be something.
And then this other thing.
Bring up. Yeah. Yeah, because then if that's, because I feel like the next thing relies on that. But I would say that, you know, what Paul was talking about there in that passage refers to the church. Right? Like that's Paul saying, we don't, you know, we're not going to judge on matters. If they come into the church, I think that's a different situation. Also, you know, part of that, and this is something I think we should discuss with him at that time, because Israel was under bondage, you know, in Rome. It was under the Roman government. That was obviously not a Christianized nation to the extent that we're working to create, right? And so in a situation where you're under tyranny and your best shot at true justice is within the church, because the civil government couldn't be relied upon whatsoever. We're kind of entering that stage in America today, although we're not quite there. We're very, very close. I mean, I don't trust our civil government to make just decisions whatsoever. But still, we are running on at least the fumes of that. So I think this passage is not talking about the ideal. It's not saying in a fully Christianized society, the church should be involved in judicial matters.
Yeah.
It's saying out of necessity right now, because they're the only ones wise enough to make those decisions. But in a Christianized society, which is what we're working towards, the civil government is the judicial division of society. It's the part of society that's meant, should be meant, that is meant to do these things. They should be doing it in accordance to the word of God. When they don't, then you go to the church, but that's not the ideal, right? That's like an emergency, like under tyranny, extreme case situation, I would say.
Yeah. And this is where I have to admit a mistake on my part. I did miss something. So let me read this out. Believers are, We believers have had city authority stripped from us for disobedience. Stripped might be by speaking of ourselves too generously. We have largely given it away. We are citizens of the heavenly city, and that can never be taken away. But on this earth, city authority can be and has been. So now what? Believers are sprinkled like salt throughout the whole world. Where should the church's jurisdiction end, and up to what weight our severity of offense? How can we possibly keep track of so many jurisdictions? The answer is beautifully simple. He is talking about the church. So I am, that is my own mistake. He is talking about the church. To which this makes so much more sense.
Way more sense. And
I definitely agree with this.
Yep. Absolutely. Time for just a little bit more? Because we're pretty much at time. There's so much in these chapters.
This is another one that is interesting. It could lend to a larger discussion that we could ask about. But this is, I think, when Mr. Terrell was bringing up, when this is kind of the part that I think everybody has an issue with, and we can kind of discuss this if this is the part or not, but he says on page 103, excommunication then in practice must be as irreversible as death apart from Christ, because it is standing in place of execution. Once a brother has been convicted of a capital offense while within the body, there is no option to rejoin the body in this life. So basically, the church should be taking capital offense should be providing the death penalty for people within the body who have committed a capital offense. Which, in this day and age, yeah, it's hard though. Because if, think about it, if the government saw that a church was murdering people.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's not technically, it's not murder because it's...
No, I know what you mean. Yeah. From their eyes, it would be murder.
Right. Yeah, this is one of those, you know, and you can't dismiss it as like, well, that just doesn't feel right because, well, if it's in the law of God, we need to discuss it and figure out if it's true. But this was, I actually had this conversation with Mr. Terrell in person and it was very fruitful. It was a great conversation. And I hope we get to have it on the show. Because he brought this up and he's like, this is probably what people are going to have an issue with.
Yes.
And you know, I made my case. I still don't believe the church, that is their responsibility. I do believe that Romans 13 makes it clear that the civil government bears the sword. So they're the ones who are in charge of executions.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
Bearing the sword of defense for the nation, but then also punishment and restitution and everything that goes along with justice. So I
wanted to also talk a little bit about, I know we're over time, but is excommunication. So I understand if someone is excommunicated for committing a capital offense, that makes sense. But what if someone is excommunicated not committing a capital offense, but is still excommunicated because they believe in, oh, I don't know. I don't know what it would be.
I know in of some kind.
But even speaking heresy would be considered a capital offense, wouldn't it?
Not capital. Well, depends on whether it's a blasphemy. Because then you start getting into blasphemy laws, but I don't think false teacher, you'd have to look into that and see.
So I definitely know in recent years, there have been several times in which the OPC even have excommunicated people when actually, if you look at what they believe, it's very similar to someone like Doug Wilson or ourselves, right. You know, and only because the OPC has become a little bit more wishy-washy.
Yeah. Yep.
Is that still then a executionable offense? But then again, I do believe Mr. Terrell would say, even if they commit it wrong, even if that specific instance is committed wrongly, should that mean we stray away from trying to do what God commands us to do?
Just because it was misused.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I get. Because, yeah. So, we'll leave that there. Definitely a conversation we can have with Mr. Carroll when he comes on. So.
Yep. Lots of great conversations. Well, thank you all for watching or listening. If you have questions about some of the things we've discussed or things you'd like us to ask Mr. Terrell himself when we have him on in a few weeks, please don't hesitate to send those to our inbox, trdshow@protonmail.com. You can also go to our show website, trdshow.net, and scroll to the bottom of the homepage. Several of you have done this week, and send us an email that way or a message. We're looking forward to hearing from you. Thank you, Jacob, for reading through those chapters. That was great. And have a great rest of your weekend, everyone. Have a wonderful Lord's Day, and we will see you on Wednesday when we're back once again to discuss current events from a biblical perspective.
And remember, everyone, in all that you do, do it as unto the Lord.